Stream from the following 10 to 11 show. Or verse E. Devasure. Balaram, who together removed the demonic rulers who were burdening the earth. The typical song is pointed out in the descriptions of the incarnation is to deal with Sudrama, or low-class men, refers to Buddha and Hope. Those two misuse they sacrifice to engage in gross sense gratification, such as the sinful killing of animals, was certainly in the category of Sudrama. As are the so-called political leaders of Kali Yuga, who perform any atrocities in the name of state management. Text 23, O mighty armed king, there are innumerable appearances and activities of the Supreme Lord of the universe, similar to those I have already mentioned. In fact, the glories of the Supreme Lord are unlimited. Thus then, the purport of the humble servants of the Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada to the 11th canto, 4th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, explains the incarnations of God as the King meaning. Translation, the Supreme Lord regularly takes advantage of wars between the demons and demigods to kill the leaders of the demons. The Lord thus encourages the demigods by protecting the universe through its various incarnations during the reigns of each monarch. The Lord also appeared as Vamana and took the earth away from Mali Maharaj on the same vacancy steps of land. The Lord then returned the entire world to the sons of Aditi. This whole chapter is a list of the incarnations of the Supreme Lord at the request of King Nini. And the Nabhyogendras, Drumala, was one of the Nabhyogendras, explains these incarnations. These incarnations will see have already been listed. This is the 11th canto, which is near the end of the Bhagavatam. And we know that at the beginning of the Bhagavatam also, a list is given by Sutta Goswami. And the famous in that list is Master Bhagavan's in that list. And in the third canto again, we get another list of avatars, which is very similar, except there's a few extra ones like Haya and Jiva added there. So we have three lists given in the Bhagavatam. And of course, throughout the Bhagavatam, we'll find these avatars describe the various forms which have been listed here are described in more detail, and some of their characteristics are given. For instance, we'll see that in the third canto, the mother and father of each avatar is given, and a brief description of his activities. And then we'll find in the third, fourth, fifth, seventh, eighth, ninth cantos, and even 11th canto, some of the pastimes of these avatars are given. And the 10th canto is dedicated to describing the pastimes of Krishna in great detail. This is all arisen. One reason is that the sages of Naimisaranya asked, this is one of the questions, please describe to us the incarnations of the Supreme Lord. Another question they ask is, what are we going to do in Kali Yuga now that Krishna has departed? Of course, the answer to that is that Srimad Bhagavatam has arisen. But what is the purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam? That is also described in the first canto where Narayana said, Vyasa, you wasted your time by writing 18 Puranas because you misled the people. Why? Because you've told them to engage in inferior activities like karma, karma kanda, because he's written tamasic puranas and rajasic puranas and sattvic puranas, and these are in gunas. And varnashram is dealing with gunas, sudras, vaishyas, kshatriyas, brahmanas. So, according to gunas, you're qualified for work, and according to gunas, you're qualified for puranas. So people in Tamagun should read the study and follow the topic Puranas. Those in Rajagun should follow Rajagun Puranas. Those in Satyagun should follow Satyagun Puranas. So you written works for people in the Gunas in the hope that by doing that they'll gradually rise up and the Sudra becomes a Vaishnava, Vaishnava becomes a Kshatriya, Kshatriya becomes a Brahmana, and a Brahmana becomes a Vaishnava. And then Vaishnava goes to the spiritual world. But unfortunately, Kali Yuga, that won't work. Everyone will simply sit where they are and become attached to whatever they're doing And the Tamasic people will remain Tamasic, and the Rajasic people will remain Rajasic, and they won't progress upwards to Satya even. This is the nature of Kali Yuga. People will misunderstand everything. So you have to simply directly state the highest thing of all, not a gradual process of elevation. You simply state the highest thing of all, which is Bhakti, and you state the highest form of the Lord Krishna. So therefore, based on that, Vyasadeva rewrote one of the Puranas that becomes the Srimad Bhagavatam, as we know it, with the list of all of the avatars, and Krishna pointed out as Swayam Bhagavan. So, in other words, Krishna is to be worshipped in Kali Yuga, because he is the only hope. Even though all avatars are wonderful, Krishna is most attractive. Therefore, in Kali Yuga, the people should simply worship Krishna by hearing his pastimes and chanting his name. So that is the basic intent of the Srimad Bhagavatam. But, of course, the sages have asked so many questions. What is the best thing for humanity and whatever? And what are the incarnations? So these are related to the main subject of Krishna, and therefore all of these different things are recited. And of course, since this is a Purana, it deals with Puranic subjects. So subscribe to the second campaign. And at the end of the Bhagavatam, that there are 10 subjects of Mahapuranas. And therefore, Bhagavatam should also confirm and list these, or describe these 10 subject matters. So therefore, we'll have all these things mentioned, even though the final conclusion is we should just hear about Krishna, because of the hope for Kali Yuga. So, therefore, we'll have all these other topics in the different cantos of the Bhagavatam, including the 11th canto. For instance, we'll find creation in the 3rd canto, and that sarga and hisarga, sub creation in the 4th canto, and sthiti, maintenance, and planetary systems in the 5th canto, and poshana in the 6th canto, protection of the Lord. So the Lord protects people, so he protects Ajana from the Yavadutas by sending the Vishnudutas. And he protects Indra from Mr. Sura. Upi, which means impressions, good and bad impressions. And that's in the 7th canto, the demons by Hiranyakasipu. Evil tendencies, and those with saintly tendencies, like Prahlad. And Manvantara. Manvantara means the different periods in one day of Brahma. So there are 14 periods of 71 yuga cycles each. It's called Manvantara. That's mentioned in this book, actually.
The second line, Manvantara.
Manvantara means the periods of Brahma. So everything occurs in a day of Brahma, usually repetitively, every day of Brahma, usually the same things happen. And each day is divided up into manvantaras, periods of manus. So there are 14 manus in one day, and each has a designated period of 71 yuga cycles, and the total is 1,000 yuga cycles. So in each of these manvantaras, there are also scheduled things that happen every day. So it's regular appearance every day of manvantaras and all the different events. And within the manvantaras, then we have the appearance of the avatars. So in a time of manvantara, so many avatars appear, like Matsya and Varaha, etc. And in Chakshusha manvantara, we have Nrsimhadeva appearing. And in Vyasatva manvantara, we have Ramachandra and Krishna and Kalki and Buddha, Balaram, etc. So everything is scheduled at certain times within the manvantara periods in the day of Brahma. And particularly the most important thing that occurs in the day of Brahma is the appearance of the Lord, obviously. It's the most important thing. So therefore we get the avatars listed. So in those topics we have manvantaras, and those are listed commonly an eighth canto. And then Isha Anupatha is another subject that's ninth canto, further talks about the Lord and his devotees, including Ramchandra. And Mukti is mentioned, liberation, that's in the 11th canto, this canto is 11th canto. And destruction, Nirodha, the ninth subject, that's 12th canto. And then the final subject, Asraya, the shelter or the cause of everything, which is Krishna, Swayam Bhagavan, that's in the 10th canto. So in this way we have all these subject matters with the intention of relating everything to Krishna, even though in other Puranas they'll have these same topics. Topics not always Krishna, maybe Shiva or maybe so many things. Agni or Brahma or whatever. But this Purana is particularly about Krishna. And Krishna is pointed out as Swayam Bhagavan. So everything must relate to him. So there are stories of the Purusha avatars and the Sarga and the Sarga, primary and secondary creations. That is there to show that ultimately God as the creator is subordinate to God as the performer of Mr. Govardhan Hill. Krishna is superior to all the Purusha avatars in the creation and destruction of the material world. So all of these ten topics are significant because they relate to the Supreme Lord, and ultimately they're under the shelter of Krishna. He is Asraya. He is the final cause of everything. So the avatars are also Lord. They're equal to Krishna because God cannot be unequal to himself. God is God. So all the avatars are God also. So they're all equal. At the same time, they're different because they have different forms, and that's described when the different avatars are described. For instance, the Yuga avatars are all God, but they're different. Why? You know, different colors. Satya Yuga avatar is white, Tritya Yuga avatar is red. So, differences there. And of course, all the other avatars are also described according to form and color. So, Vamana is small, he's a dwarf. Varaha is a pig. Narsimhadeva's got a lion head. They all have different forms. It's the same God, but he has a different form and different color. And he has different activities. Ramchandra does particular activities like building the bridge to Lanka and killing Ravana. Kapila does not have those activities. Kapila simply teaches his mother, Yavavuti. Varaha uses his tusks to lift the river out of the Garbhada ocean. Kapila doesn't do that. Or Buddha doesn't do that. Kalki rides on a horse and kills all the demons at the end of this Kali Yuga. And the other avatars don't do that either. So they have different forms and they have different activities. Subsequently, they show different amounts of qualities. So Kapila, what qualities does he show? He shows knowledge, Sankhya. Ramchandra shows more than that. Of course, he shows knowledge. He kills demons. He shows heroism, just killed Ravana, has love for Sita, etc. So these are the things that Kapila never shows. So difference in qualities are also there. Yet it's all one Lord. Except for Chaktivedya avatars. They're not the Lord, they're Jivas. But they're raised up because they got special powers given by the Lord permanently and eternally. So Narayana Muni and Parsaram are in that category. Kumaras are in that category. So there are specific Chaktivedya avatars who are numbered, six, and then there are the full avatars. But among these full avatars, they show different amounts of qualities. When these lists are given here, the activities they do, some are more significant than others. Therefore, we classify them. That doesn't mean to say that this avatar is inferior, because it's all one God. In fact, the nature of God is he has inconceivable powers to be several forms at once. Because they're all eternal. It's not that the Lord appears and then he disappears. No, he's eternal. So all these forms are eternal. But they're also one. So that's not possible for us to conceive of. Yeah? If something is one, then it cannot be something else at the same time. You know, things are different, objects are different, but it can be different forms that be one at the same time. That's his nature. Yeah? Of course, in a more dramatic way, Krishna has shown this in Dwarka, where he appears in 16,108 palaces simultaneously. In that way, he's one Krishna with the same form, but he's doing different activities and showing different qualities simultaneously. So he can do that. And then when he walks out of the palaces and goes to the assembly hall, suddenly they all turn into one form. And when he goes back in the palaces, he turns into 16,108 forms again, and he's doing different activities. That is the wonderful nature of Krishna. But more than just one form, he can have all these other forms as well. And they go on. In the material world, they're always appearing in some universe. And as one Supreme Lord in all these different forms. And the Lord is also in the forms of Karna Raksha Vishnu, Kapha Raksha Vishnu, Shira Raksha Vishnu, and Paramatma in the heart. In all the jivas. In all the universes. So he has uncountable forms, unlimited forms, which are different. Paramatma has a certain function, he has a certain form, and Krishna has a different form, a different function. So all ultimately are under the shelter of Krishna. So he is called Swayam Bhagavan, even though there are many, many forms, and they're all one. We distinguish Krishna and put him in a different category. Why? Why should we do that if they're all God? Why do we single up Krishna and put him in a higher category? He's Swayam Bhagavan. Everyone else is Bhagavan. Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan. Huh? It's the same God. Must have the same powers and the same qualities and the same activities and whatever they're all on. But as I said, it shows different amounts of qualities and forms. So therefore, in manifestation, Krishna shows more. It's not that nobody has them, because then they cannot be equal to God. They're all equal, but Krishna manifests more qualities than all the other forms. So that is the significance of Krishna. So why are we still sure about qualities? A little more qualities, one or two more qualities. What's better about Krishna? There's only that. Why is distinguishing and put him in another category? Because those qualities are very special. And they distinguish Krishna by making him most attractive. We say Krishna means all attractive. So that is the nature of Krishna. He's more attractive than any other form of God. It sounds contrary because God should be all attractive in any form. And it's true. But still, as I said, God in different forms manifests different qualities. So Krishna manifests extra qualities to make him extra attractive. And the nature of Krishna is such that even Krishna manifests himself in different forms. Even well, the same forms, but slightly more qualities. So in Dwarka, Krishna is called Purna. And in Mathura, he's Purnatara. He's more perfect, slightly more attractive. And in Vrindavan, he is Purnatama. He is most attractive. So slightly more manifestation. Even in Krishna. So, in this way, the Lord can manifest different amounts of qualities, even though we say they all have those qualities as Bhagavan still. But Krishna manifests significantly more, and this makes him more attractive. What is so attractive about Krishna is his madhurya aspect, his sweetness, which means intimacy that arises from those qualities that make it very, very special. And ultimately that intimacy makes one even forget that Krishna is God. And when one writes him only as a child, son, mother, friend, etc. So that is in Vrindavan.
there's a slight manifestation in Matura Dwarka, that's why they're considered less. They are Krishna's God, but he's also our son. So, but in Vrindavan, they see Krishna only as Krishna. Mother Yasoda sees Krishna as her son, without nothing else. So, in this way, the center of the Gaudiya philosophy is to distinguish Krishna from all the other forms. And the other Sangha's will argue with that, say Vishnu is supreme. He is the one that manifests all the qualities. But we say, no, it's the opposite. Those are the Bhagavatam. Therefore, we take the Srimad Bhagavatam as the main authority of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. Bhagavatam being the final conclusion of Veda Vyas, after all the other Puranas are written. And the Puranas are written as a response to the Vedas. He compiled the Vedas and divided them up, and then he found that people could not understand them. So he wrote the Mahabharata and the Puranas as the commentary on the Vedas, natural commentary on the Vedas. Okay? And of those, the Srimad Bhagavatam is considered to be the final Purana after Narada told him to do things in another way. So Srimad Bhagavatam is the final conclusion. And then it's also considered to be the natural commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. But on the Sutra came in truth, Vyasa's work to find the conclusion of the Upanishads, which are ultimately the sum of the Vedas, the higher part of the Vedas. So the Upanishads are very complex and hard to understand, so therefore he wrote the Vedanta Sutra to explain those. But even the Vedanta Sutra is hard to understand. So therefore, Bhagavatam is also the commentary on that to give a proper understanding what is the conclusion of the Vedanta Sutra. And that is echoed in the first verse of the Bhagavatam. Jama Jasa Yataha. So, in this way, we take the Gaudiya Sampradaya, Chaitanya takes Bhagavatam as final authority, and Swayam Bhagavatam as Krishna. So, what we have here is the lists of the different avatars going throughout the day of Brahma. There's also a significant question by the sages of Nanda Saranya, because, of course, all avatars contribute to the progress of the material world. They kill the demons and protect the devotees and give teachings at different times. So therefore, throughout the day of Brahma, we have the appearances of the Lord. And also, the which is described here, Deva Asura Yudhi, Shadanta Patini, to kill the leaders of the demons and protect the devotees, Devadas. But also, the inclinations are important to understand that we cannot concoct forms of the Lord. In other words, what are listed, these are the forms. And if we say, well, there's another form, then we have to have a Shastric reference. So, Bhagavatam is the conclusion of the Puranas and the Upanishads and the Vedas. So, we look in the Bhagavatam, if it's listed there, fine, it's just an incarnation. If it's not listed, then we don't accept it. So in this way, we can distinguish claims as to who is avatar, etc. So, that's good, but then people will say, well, I am Kalki. That is a claim made in India now, that people are claiming to be Kalki already. We also know that the explanation of when they also appear is there. So Nrsimhadeva appears in Chakshusha Manvantara, which is millions and millions of years ago. Ramchandra appeared in the 24th cycle of Vaivasvata Manvantara, which is four cycles before our cycle, present cycle. And so that's, 16 million years ago, approximately. It's Ramchandra's appearance. And, Brahma and Kurma, they appear in Swayamruva Manvantara, which is the beginning of the day of Brahma. It was long ago. We're halfway through the day of Brahma already. So, many, many millions of years have gone by. And Kalki appears at the end of this Yuga cycle, which has a specific duration of time that started after Krishna disappeared. That's the beginning of Kali Yuga. And according to the Bhagavad Gita, lasts for over 400,000 years. So Kalki appears at the end of that, not at the beginning. So therefore we can discount those claims he's Kalki, someone is Kalki avatar, whatever. And if they just say the avatar and they don't give a name, then that also is not proper. And so all the avatars are different with their forms and their qualities and their activities and their time periods. Everything fits exactly. And this goes on every day of Brahma, normally, there's some exceptions, but normally this is the way in which things go on. So, the sages ask this so that we don't become confused about claims of different avatars. But the other point, of course, is to show the great powers of the Supreme Lord, that He can manifest Himself in so many forms, and at the same time be one. And ultimately, that of all these forms, it is Krishna who is Asraya, or the shelter of everything, because He manifests everything. And all others manifest partially. That is the whole purpose. So here in the 11th canto, again, we get a summary after the 10th canto describes Krishna as who is the Asraya and Swayamvara Bhagavan with all those wonderful pastimes. Yeah. To get a summary here again of all of these different avatars to show that they are expansions of Krishna. So it's a when we talk about the avatar, we should understand this is Kirtan. This is a glorification of Krishna as the source of everything. An example is given in the Brahma Samhita, where it describes a candle and another candle lights, another candle is lit from that, another candle is lit from that. So they're all candles, they all have power of light, etc. Same thing. But when it's first, on its first candle. So, and the other way of explaining it is in the Lagu Bhagavad Gita, it's like the moon. So we have Purnima. We have Chaturdasi and Triodasi and Dwadasi and Ekadasi, etc. What's the difference? Not just name. The amount of light is also different. So Purnima is full moon and Amavasya is zero light, and in between we got gradually a little more until we get 21. But one moon, not different. So the Supreme Lord is like that also. He's one, but He will manifest different amounts of qualities in different forms. And when it is extremely different, then it actually becomes Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva is also Supreme Lord, but He's not called Supreme Lord in the same way. Of course, it's Guna Avatar. Why? Because significant difference in qualities are manifested in Him from the other forms. So therefore, we put Him in a category called Shiva instead. So that way, another example to give it is that of you take a match, with a match, you can light a fire. So if you want to, you light a match and you can burn down a house, you can burn down a town with a match, one match, if you do it nicely. So I have that power to do that. And you take a big fire. A big fire also can do the same thing. A bonfire, we have a big fire, we can do the same thing. But there's also a difference in some of the qualities. With a match, on a cold day, you cannot keep yourself warm. You have a bonfire, big fire, yes, you can keep yourself warm. And so there's different functions of the different fires. So Krishna's like a big bonfire, and avatars are like little matches or whatever. And certain amounts of functions and qualities and things like that. But what Krishna can do is much more. So whatever is manifested in the small amounts of manifestation are also in the beauty. So whatever qualities and activities are manifested in any other forms also manifests in Krishna. But then we may say, well, Krishna Vrindavan manifests sweetness, you know, as a little boy. So how can he manifest creation, destruction, all this like Purusha avatars and others? But yes, in spite of the fact that it looks like it's impossible if you're pure like a little boy son of Mother Yasoda, helpless little child, how can you manifest all powers? But Krishna can do that. So he does that. So he manifests himself as Vishwarupa to Mother Yasoda, appearing with all the universes inside his body. But the nature of this is such that even the Mother Yasoda sees it, she rejects it. And says, this is not Krishna. Krishna's my son. So Krishna can manifest all. He manifests the universes, all the Vishnu forms, creators of universes, to Brahma within Vrindavan. So yet even the Vrindavan Krishna shows he is master of creation. He is the source of all the Vishnu forms who are manifesting universes. Karnadakshaya Vishnu, Shiradakshaya Vishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. He is the source of all these. And there's millions of those. Because each cowherd boy was a Vishnu form. And how many cowherd boys were there? Billions. The countless forms of cowherd boys who and calves who turned into Vishnu forms. And all the Vishnu forms are simply extensions of Krishna. They all turn into one Krishna who is a small boy. So within Vrindavan, Krishna manifests his power as well to the suitable persons. So he manifests the Kamala, manifests the Mother Yasoda, etc. So in this way, Krishna in Vrindavan manifests greatness and power as Supreme Lord, as Creator and Destroyer, as well as the sweetness. And he manifests more powers than the Vishnu forms or any of the avatar forms. And he manifests those pastimes as well. So we may ask, well, how can Krishna manifest Ramchandra's pastimes in Vrindavan? And actually, he does. It's described that in when playing with the cowherd boys, he can act all the different avatar forms. He's playing Rama and all these other forms with the cowherd boys as well. So everything is actually included within Krishna, all the other forms and all the other pastimes and all the other qualities. Whatever they have, he also has. Plus, he manifests more. So that makes him special. So that is why Krishna is called Swayambhakaran, among all the different forms.
You kind of use the kind of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appears in the Yuga dance. When Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu doesn't appear, what is the Yuga dance? The kind of Yuga.
Oh, it's still not Sankirtan.
Yeah.
It may not be Krishna's name.
Well.
Huh? Because all Krishna appears only once on the day of Brahma. And then after that, Lord Chaitanya appears and then he says Krishna's name. But before that, Krishna has not appeared. So they will the more familiar with other forms and names of the Supreme Lord. So it may be Vishnu's name or some other avatar name or various names.
Just one more question. I was reading somewhere that there are a couple of forms of the Lord that are considered not permanent, such as Mahini.
There's a category given, I think that's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, for instance, it mentions, and also in the Lagavata Tamrita, Rupa Goswami explains that. As I said, we can talk about the Purnima and the different phases of the moon, so there's different, it classifies from topmost down to the bottom. And so those which are less well known, show less powers, and appear for just a short period of time, and then those are put at the bottom. Those that teach, you know, like Kapila and Hamsa and Mohini, etc., are put in one category, and a little higher is more than higher and higher like that. So, according to the significance of their pastimes and how much detail is given in the Puranas, then they're classed like that. But they're all considered to be Supreme Lord, but they just function in a different way. Usually, those who teach Gyan or give knowledge are put in a lower category, like find that what is it, Navatreya and Kapila and others, they're like teachers, so they don't show that much power if they just give some jnana. Kumaras or also give jnana, they get knowledge, so they don't show that many powers, so they're usually in a lesser category. Those like Varaha and Matsya and Kurma and Vamana, they show significant powers in there. Most of the Purans will mention them and quite elaborately describe their pastimes. They're put in a higher category. And then ultimately we have on the top, we have Purna Avatar, Sri. That is Srimade, Rama, and Krishna. And of those, Krishna is put on the top. Classified.
We accept Parshuram as a Leela avatar. Jagat Swami is
that master. Yeah, he's actually a Shastra avatar.
And yeah, in Bhagavatam 9th canto, it's mentioned as Shaktadesh.
Yeah. So within the Leela avatars, some are Shaktadesh avatars. Narada Muni is a Shaktadesh avatar, and Kumara is, and Prithu is also Shaktadesh avatar.
So we accept them as the jivas, but who are, you know?
Special, have special powers that most jivas don't have. And they also have eternal forms in the spiritual world. Those forms are eternal in the spiritual world as well, those Shaktivesh forms. There's called Amesh forms in Shaktivesh avatar.
But why there is difference in the teachings of those avatars like Satyadeva and Buddha? Why there was difference in the teachings of various traditions and Krishna?
Oh, why is there difference in teachings? Well, why is there different teachings in the Vedas? The Vedas of Karma Kanda, Jnana Kanda, and Bhakti and Yoga and everything. Why does Bhagavad Gita have different teachings? If we just isolate third chapter, then we'll think Krishna's teaching us to do Karma Yoga. So, in the Bhagavatam, like 11th canto, Krishna's teaching Mukti, how to merge into Brahman. Why is the Bhagavatam teaching merging in Brahman? So, we'll find in most of the scriptures, they'll teach various things. And the Vedas teach various things. And everyone will say, well, this is too confusing. Why isn't the Lord very explicit? The answer is given in the Bhagavatam itself, where it is said, the Lord likes to be mysterious. He does not speak directly in scripture. Parokshavad is called. So he doesn't reveal everything directly. Just like Vedas are not given to sudras. Any of them they're given, they can't understand them. So some things are not stated explicitly. They're hidden in the scriptures. And even bhakti is considered hidden. It is rahasya. It's a secret. And even in Bhagavatam, everything is not revealed directly. Hidden. Radharani is not mentioned at all. Hidden. So many things are hidden, even in the Bhagavatam. Not because people are unqualified for that. Sukadeva was, of course, speaking to Pariksit. Pariksit was qualified, therefore he understood the meaning. And therefore, in the 11th canto and the 12th canto, when Jnana is glorified, Pariksit understands the meaning. This is all secondary. It is not the primary thing. We know that Swami Bhagavatam is the ultimate. That's the asura. But it's hidden from other people. Even the Bhagavatam is meant as the ultimate cure for everything. Still, it also appeals to other people, attracts them, and also hides the substance from them. Hopefully, by association with the devotees, they will understand the real meaning. But it hides things. So therefore, from the beginning, it is hidden, and they will take another meaning from Bhagavatam and not understand Krishna, according to the qualification. So in this way, various things are stated, and the avatars themselves will say different things. So the Kumaras talk about Jnana, Brahman, like glorified Brahman, Adhapatreya glorifies Brahman, Buddha, of course, glorifies non-violence, and Sunyavad, etc. So they teach specifically for specific people, just like certain Shastras teach Jnana, Upanishads teach Jnana, merging in Brahman as well. So for different types of people who are different qualifications, these things are taught. So we have karma for some people, jnana for some people, bhakti for others. But, as I said, Narada Muni has said, in Kali Yuga, don't teach all of this, simply teach bhakti. People are not qualified for karma and jnana. Only they should take directly to bhakti. And in order to do that, one has to be qualified for bhakti, which is the highest qualification. So that's a little difficult. How can bhakti is the high qualification? How can everybody do it in Kali Yuga when the most disqualified? Therefore, we have now Sankirtan. This makes it available to everyone. And we have the special blessing of Krishna, who's most attractive. And we have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is more merciful. This is how we can spread bhakti in Kali Yuga.
Why did Krishna reveal himself, say, at the end of Bhakti Yuga, to people are less intelligent creatures, especially in Kali Yuga?
Well, I suppose one reason is because that way it's close to Kali Yuga, and the people of Kali Yuga get the special influence of him by that way.
This is his highest form that he reveals in this day. I mean, Krishna is his highest.
Yes. So it's like this way, both get advantage. Dwarpayuki gets advantage in Kali Yuga sometimes by appearing at the borderline between the two. He only appears once in the whole day. You could also say, why doesn't Krishna appear every yuga? I mean, that's for everybody. But that's his will. He only appears once in the day of Brahma. In Vaibhasavamanantara. In the 28th yuga cycle, at the end of Dwarpa Yuga, that's his appearance, fixed. Yeah. And others, there's other people, other forms take their having influence and teach at other times.
Why
God people cannot understand the personal form of God? It's a prejudice because of the material world, and we see material forms, material qualities, etc. So we think God shouldn't have any of those things, or naturally. So if there is a God, then he must not have any of this. So then we say, impersonal. This is logical. It's not completely logical, but from some people's prejudice, they may think like that. That's all. It's a likelihood that he wouldn't have all his qualities. That is so. Yes, God does not have any material qualities, and therefore he's called Nirguna. So we also believe that. No material qualities. But he has spiritual qualities. So that is a little difficult to understand for some people. They say, he has no material qualities, he should have no qualities. So we say, no, he has no material qualities, but he has spiritual qualities. Nevertheless, even for us, it may become difficult to understand, because when we talk about Krishna being blue, that's one of the qualities. What do we mean by blue? Not blue. Not blue. We will relate it to a material color. We use material words. We have material concepts. Then Krishna has lotus eyes. What lotus we refer to? Lotus we see. So how does the material world is pink? That one we refer to. So even for us and the scriptures, they're using material objects and so-called material words and material colors and whatever to describe the beauty of Krishna and his form. So that people can attach it to this. It's material. Lotus is material, pink is material, blue is material, black is material, yellow is material, gold is jewels, jewels are material. So you can become very confused and think, yeah, it's all material again. But of course, we can say it's a spiritual lotus, spiritual glue, whatever. Nevertheless, yes, when we see the words, we get material connotation, obviously, because the words for us, blue means that blue, we know the material, pink is pink, etc. So, yes, that is so for us now, but if we understand that it is something like that, but it is spiritual, then we should not be confused. And by the process of bhakti, then we have a realization of Krishna, then we understand the real nature of that blue and the real nature of that yellow or pink or whatever, and the form of Krishna. It is something like our form, but not like the material aspects of it, but it's a similar type of form, but it is spiritual. So we could say it is something like this conception we have now. So, in other words, when we have realization, then we understand the real nature of the words. They have a real spiritual import when we have realization. Now, you get something, because we do have some bhakti, therefore they have significance. For someone who has no bhakti, yes, this is material scripture only. It's only material words. Yeah? So all Vaishnava want to quote Krishna. The words come from an all Vaishnava, it is all material scripture. They read the Bible, it's material scripture only. Poison. Snake like a poison in the milk. So the same words from the devotee take on spiritual meaning, according to what's realization. Yeah. And when we read with realization, then we see the real spiritual meaning of everything. So the words are not material anymore, they're spiritual. So according to our consciousness, we will get more and more out of the words. And therefore the blue and the pink and the whatever that we see in the lotus are no longer material, they're spiritual when we have full realization. So even now, when we're not fully realized, we understand these concepts and try to grasp them, and we understand they're spiritual and realize that bhakti. This helps us in the real, it guides us in the right direction of realization. On the other hand, if we think that Brahma, the Lord has no form, no qualities, etc., and we concentrate on that, that's the realization we get. We realize Brahman, God has no form and no qualities. So, by using these descriptions, then we realize that form. So then they must be spiritual, because a material thing cannot give a spiritual realization. So we say spiritual realization, these words which are all spiritual. But we do not fully understand the spiritual nature of the moment. But by having devotion, at least they don't give us material realization.
I think in some cases Prabhupada referred to Jesus as being like a Vaishnava or like a guru for us. But there's a lot of impersonalism in Christianity in the sense that although Jesus talked about God the Father, very few people in Christianity seem to be interested in who is God the Father and things like that. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on why there would be impersonalism in Christianity?
Why there would be? Well, I think one reason is that the the Old Testament is basically, a lot of it is impersonal. And the Jews, in general, don't accept God as with a form. I think with Satyarajan's interviews with the rabbis, they more or less reject the idea of form of God. So it's very similar to Islam, that concept of God. They don't want to give God a personal form at all. Maybe represented by a fire, a burning bush or something, and he can speak, words, but ultimately we shouldn't give a form to God. God hasn't even got a name, and Jehovah comes from some funny combination of syllables, which actually means you cannot speak the name of God, so he doesn't even have a name, technically speaking. So a lot of that comes from the Judaic Old Testament influence. It's interesting to note, of course, that Catholics do more attribute personal things to God. So therefore, in the art, they have God as a person, like Michelangelo and whatever. There's God creating the person. So they do give them a form of some sort. And in Catholic iconography, it's there to some degree. Personalism is there to some degree. So Christianity, to some degree, is more personal because they have the idea of love, etc., compassion, whatever, God. Old Testament generally is a fear concept to God. You fear God, is an angry God, who will punish you, cast you in hell, etc. And in the New Testament, Christ speaks of, you know, love. So it's more compassion and mercy there. So in that sense, it's progress in one sense. As for the form, even there they don't speak. Christ doesn't speak much about that. So therefore, it remains that impersonal idea of God remains.
Okay.
Very good.